General Motors made a billion plus.
But Wall Street has other things to worry about.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, good day to you. I'm Bob Moon.
And I'm Bill Radke. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Thursday, August 12th. On the one hand, General Motors looks to be on the road to recovery. But on the other hand, weekly jobless claims just took a surprising jump.
And Bill, there's that old saying about economists having too many hands, plenty of other hands pointing to signs of a stalling recovery in China and Europe today. Also, now we know why those eggs are green. They're 50 years old today. But first,
we found out this morning new unemployment claims continued to rise last week. Let's say good morning to economist Diane Swonk of Mesirow Financial. She joins us every Thursday from Chicago. Hi, Diane.
Good morning.
How concerned are you that yet more people filed for unemployment benefits last week?
Well, there were distortions to the data from the auto industry, but that said, anyway, this data is cut. The employment situation is still dismal.
How dismal?
Dismal enough that the Federal Reserve is likely to move further than it did this week and actually begin purchasing assets as we move into the fall to stimulate a really moribund economy.
Yeah, interesting. Getting back to serious stimulating again. Now, the Fed could have made that move earlier this week, Diane, when it made its big announcement about the economy. Why does it hesitate to buy mortgage-backed securities?
Well, the real issue is that mortgage-backed security purchases is really flirting with industrial policy. It is picking winners and losers, and that's very important because the Fed would like to be more neutral about the economy. That's why it compromised and said it would buy Treasury bonds, lowering rates for everyone in the economy. But let's face it, the housing market is one of the weak spots, one of the parts that got us into this recession.
Right. So and isn't Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke famously a student of the Great Depression?
He is an expert on the Great Depression, and he'd rather do what he can now than walk away and say that he tried and failed than didn't try at all. It was the Fed's failure to act during the Great Depression and weakness in the housing market, which were two factors that contributed to the depth and longevity of that period.
Not suggesting things are near that bad, but an interesting story to watch. Economist Diane Swonk of Mesirow Financial. Thanks, Diane.
Thank you.
Most of us probably think of the TARP, the Troubled Assets Relief Program, as a bailout for the American financial system. True, the U.S. taxpayer certainly footed the $300 billion bill for all those loans to banks, but a report today says we also bailed out banks overseas. Marketplace's Jeff Horwitz joins me to talk about it. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning, Bill.
How did U.S. bailout money make it to banks overseas?
Well, the financial system's totally globalized. That's no surprise to anybody, right? So when the U.S. bails out a big failed insurance company like AIG, AIG's doing business all over the world. Elizabeth Warren chairs this congressional oversight panel for the TARP.
Banks in France and Germany received billions, yet the U.S. bore the whole $70 billion risk of the AIG capital injection program.
When AIG collapsed, AIG was on the hook to lots of banks because it had insured their rotten investments. The panel traced 87 banks that benefited from aid to AIG and found that half of those were foreign.
But, Jeff, as you said, the financial system is global and everybody knows that. So why is this a problem?
Well, Warren's frustrated that none of TARP's administrators seem to be keeping track. And the panel found a big imbalance in the global bailout effort. The U.S. rescue gave money to 700 banks all over the world. Warren says the other developed countries' bailout packages combined reached fewer than 50.
If the U.S. had gathered more information about the flow of rescue funds, it could have asked other countries to share the pain.
Warren says if we are so lucky as to have to do this again, we need more international collaboration and a better real-time way to follow the money.
Marketplace's Jeff Horwitz. Thanks, Jeff.
You're welcome, Bill.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, August 12th. I'm Bob Moon in for Steve Chiotakis. For the latest look at the markets, go to the numbers at marketplace.org. We're going to get a global perspective now, what's happening in business and economics around the world and how it affects us here in the U.S. For a while, global and American economic hopes have been pinned on continued growth in China. But the Chinese economy seems to be cooling down. Fresh indicators of China's economy are all pointing to a slowdown. Domestic economic production is slow, and manufacturing growth there is down. Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports.
Last year at this time, China's economy was hot, but there was a downside. It was fueled by property speculation and unwise investments on the part of local governments. Beijing is clamping down on lending, the economy is responding, and now the party's over. There's a debate whether China will have a soft landing or a hard landing, or possibly a
long landing.
Peking University economist Michael Pettis says all you have to do is look back to countries that have had so-called lost decades, like Japan had in the 90s. That's what's in store for China, he says.
It's a very difficult process of adjusting from an economy that is heavily investment and export-driven to one that is domestic-driven.
In his lost decade scenario for China, Pettis foresees domestic economic growth rates declining to 5 or 6%. Considering the growth rate in the U.S. is 2%, it almost makes you wish for a lost decade. Of course, other economists disagree, opting to see this latest slowdown as a response to China's efforts to rein in bad loans and to rebalance its economy. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
This morning, there's word industrial production in the 16 countries that use the euro fell unexpectedly in June. That's adding to fears that economic growth in Europe may not be as strong as anticipated. Plus, the UK is fretting about its own deteriorating prospects. From London Marketplace's Stephen Beard has more.
Britain's tabloids have called him Swervin Mervyn, the head of Britain's central bank, Mervyn King. He's well known for his sometimes evasive performances in public. But this time, at a special news conference, there was no mistaking Mervyn King's message. It was gloomy. He warned of lower growth than expected. This is partly due to a lack of bank lending, the same problem as in the US. King said the UK faces a long, hard road back to full recovery.
Whereas crises occur suddenly, they fade only gradually. It will take many years before bank balance sheets and fiscal positions return to anything like normal.
In spite of that grim forecast, some economists feel that Mervyn King is actually over-optimistic. They fear the new government's plans to slash public spending and cut Britain's record budget deficit could tip the UK back into recession. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Breaking news of sorts, we're all getting older, every one of us. So here's a problem we'll all need to think about at some point, how to let the folks live independently as they get older while we still keep a caring eye on them. One company is offering a high-tech solution. From our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner reports.
After his third stroke, Bob Braun could not live alone anymore. His daughter Ellen didn't want to put him in a nursing home far away, but she also didn't have the space for him to move right in with her.
You know, my dad would listen to the TV blaring, and I just needed an extra room for him to have his space and me to have mine.
She hired architects to draw up an addition to her home. There was the zoning board to deal with. Before she could start construction, her dad died. There's a company in Virginia that promises to make that whole process easier and less expensive.
You could have a med cottage within 48 hours.
Ken Dupin is the inventor of the Med Cottage, a little prefab home that sits in the backyard. It leases for $2,000 a month. Behind that vinyl exterior, there are motion detectors.
If someone doesn't get out of the bed, let's say it's 10 o'clock in the morning, and the sensor says that they have never gone to the bathroom, they've never gone to the kitchen, then you would call them or check on them.
Or even walk across the yard and
visit them, whatever it is that you would need to do.
The house is smart. It knows the temperature of the room and whether your dad remembered to take his medication. There are floor-level cameras to monitor falls. All that information feeds real-time into a website that you can check like email. An iPod app is in the works.
That's right. It's really just a great way to connect.
Engineer Scott Mensch helped design the brains of the Med Cottage. He's rigged up the same technology in airports and office complexes.
For instance, in Dubai, over 30,000 buildings all talk back to a global command center using the technology.
I put this concept to Ellen Braun, the one who was planning that addition on her house. She liked the convenience.
But maybe it's the thought of monitoring everything so much that makes it seem a little not like family.
The Med Cottage should come on the market by January. Given the millions of baby boomers and their parents, its inventor is hoping for more than a cottage industry. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, August 12th. I'm Bill Radke. For the latest look at the markets, go to the numbers at marketplace.org. The letters BP have become synonymous with Gulf oil spill, but they were supposed to stand for Beyond Petroleum, at least according to the marketing campaign. Well, some people do want to get beyond petroleum, even in the heart of oil country. Yesterday, we introduced you to a Texas oil man who's gone green. Now we meet a Louisiana native who set his state up with the strongest solar tax rebates in the nation. Here's Marketplace's Chrissy Clark.
This is the story of how Nick Gautreau went from being a newly elected state senator for an oil-loving district in southern Louisiana to this.
They call me the godfather of solar.
It's a mantle he's not entirely comfortable with.
Because it's associated with, and I'll be honest, they call them tree huggers. When you talk about green, they think about a tree hugger.
And Gautreau says in Cajun country, it's not trees, but oil rigs that people embrace and the jobs that come with them. No tree hugging was involved in the making of the Godfather of Solar. What was involved was a phone call that Gautreau got soon after he was elected. The guy on the other line was the son of his first grade teacher.
Miss Libin Broussard, her son called me up and he says, look, I'm building a subdivision. Does the state have any type of tax incentives that would help me put solar hot water heaters on these homes? And I said, no, we don't have anything.
And then Gautreau thought, maybe they should. He knew nothing about solar energy, but he had friends who'd served in Iraq, and he figured anything to help reduce our dependence on foreign oil was a good thing.
You know what? Louisiana is the leader in the oil and gas industry. Why can't we be the leader in alternative energy?
So he wrote a bill, the strongest in the nation, a state tax rebate for homeowners that cut the cost of installing solar panels in half. But when it started moving through the state legislature, he got more phone calls, this time from people he'd never met in the National Environmental Movement. They wanted to help lobby for the bill.
I put all these people in my iPhone as solar. I just type in solar and they all pop up. And they were saying, man, you just don't know what you got there. We're going to come testify in favor of it. And I said, guys, just sit in the background because I'm afraid when there's too many people testifying and all of a sudden it draws attention.
And so quietly, in 2007, Gautreau got the bill passed. Since then, about 100 solar businesses have cropped up in Louisiana, bringing a whole new set of jobs to the economy. Just don't call them green.
Just talk about good paying jobs. Let's stop the green jobs because, listen, in the oil and gas industry, you hear good paying jobs. Why do jobs need a color?
I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
The housing slump, of course, not only hurts people's net worth, it hurts their confidence. And yesterday, stock investors also showed a drop in confidence. The Dow Industrials had their worst daily fall in more than a month. So does confidence need to come before an economic recovery, or is it the other way around? Here's Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith.
Businesses aren't hiring, consumers aren't buying, and investors are playing it safe. Is the economy suffering from a massive case of low self-esteem?
One can argue, you know, technically that the recession is over. It doesn't feel that way right now to consumers.
Lynn Franco is an economist at the Conference Board. It's been studying consumer confidence since the 60s. She says the board's confidence index is about half of what it is when the economy's growing.
If consumers remain this pessimistic, I think the likelihood for consumer spending bouncing back is less likely.
I don't put a great deal of confidence in consumer confidence.
That's investment economist Gary Schilling. He says confidence is crucial for the economy, but measuring it is tricky.
It's really more of an art than a science.
Schilling points out that consumer confidence tends to rise a month after consumer spending does. Apparently, the clothes do make the man, or at least the market. Schilling and economist Lynn Franco do agree on one thing, though. Jobs are the key to consumer confidence and economic recovery. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Car sales are up in general. Thing is, manufacturers expected this, but now of all things, there's a supply shortage. And customers can't get the models they're ready to buy. April Domboski reports.
New car sales plummeted after the economic meltdown. They dropped by 6 million between 2007 and 2009. As a result, fewer cars are trickling down to used car lots, and the price of clunkers is going up. Auto industry economist Paul Taylor says that's pushing buyers back to new cars.
People who would normally buy used cars saying, well, it's not that much more to get the new one.
Trouble is, manufacturers are coming up short on supply, especially when it comes to trucks and sport utility vehicles. When General Motors took the government's bailout money, it also took the recommendation to slash production and focus on smaller, fuel-efficient cars. But American consumers want their SUVs.
There's been times where we've had people practically fistfighting over Equinoxes.
That's Chevy's new midsize SUV. Gordon Stewart owns four Chevrolet dealerships in Georgia, Florida, and Michigan. He says rather than wait 8 weeks for a new Equinox, customers are moving on.
The first place they go is usually either Ford or Toyota.
But those companies are having supply issues of their own. I'm April Demboski for Marketplace.
More privacy concerns are being raised about Google and its Street View mapping service. By the end of the year, 20 German cities will have photos of their neighborhoods posted on Google in the face of vocal protests. The search giant says it has a solution, but as the BBC's Tristana Moore reports from Berlin, critics are questioning the timing of the solution.
Google says property owners and renters can apply online to have pictures of their homes blocked out and made unrecognizable. The internet giant has imposed a 4-week deadline, and data protection officials have accused Google of announcing the plans unexpectedly, claiming many Germans are on holiday over the summer and won't have time to use the online tool. But Google says it will implement all written requests and says the opt-out has been in place since last year. With Germany's Nazi legacy, the country has very strict privacy laws, and Germans are wary of what they regard as an intrusion into their private lives. Chris Watson is at the law firm CMS Cameron McKenna.
You don't know which part of the day what is going to be seen, how long it's going to stay on there for. And, you know, you can be doing something perfectly innocent but looking slightly odd, which has been captured on film, and people get very embarrassed about that.
The privacy commissioner in Hamburg also has concerns over how Google will deal with the data once it's captured and how it will be stored. In Berlin, I'm the BBC's Tristana Moore for Marketplace.
And finally, happy birthday, Sam I Am.
That's right. Dr. Seuss's Green Eggs and Ham was published 50 years ago today. Publishers Weekly says it is the fourth best-selling English-language children's book of all time, right behind a book called Tootle, which honestly, Bob, I had never heard of, The Tale of Peter Rabbit, which my daughter loves, and number one, The Pokey Little Puppy.
But it's Green Eggs and Ham. We'll never be able to get out of our heads after all the bedtime reading and a Seussical Broadway musical and this TV cartoon special.
I do so like Green Eggs and Ham. Thank you, Sam I Am.
I recognize Tigger's voice there, Paul Winchell. By the way, the publisher of the Green Eggs and Ham story bet Dr. Seuss he couldn't write a children's book using only 50 words. Those 50 famous words are at Marketplace.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Bob Moon. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.